Hey everyone, we are recapping Chief of War Episode 3, and there may be spoilers ahead. Also, if you want to skip the recap, feel free to jump ahead to the 3-minute mark, Thanks for listening and enjoy this episode of Feathers and Fire. Aloha and welcome to Feathers and Fire, HPR's Chief of War After Show podcast, providing deeper discussion and additional context to the Apple TV Plus series. I'm Russell Subiono.
Aloha mai, and I'm Mehana Makainai. Today we'll be discussing Episode 3, House of Flowers Part 1. And Russell, I gotta say, my favorite episode so far, which actually contained my least favorite scene, so kind of interesting. But I'm really excited to talk story about this one, so let's get into it.
Yeah, very excited about this. Let's do the recap of the episode. So we pick up the story 1 year after the events of Episode 2. So Kaiana continues to travel with the British ship, learning to speak English and learning about the outside world from his shipmate, Tony. And Tony will be a character that becomes prominent later on. Ka'ahumanu is living in Waipio Valley on Hawaii Island along with Kaiana's family. Meanwhile, Kahekili is expanding his presence on Oahu, building structures and demanding the loyalty of the chiefs. Then we get our introduction of Kamehameha. He's played by Kauai kalo farmer Kainamakua in his very first on-screen role. And Kamehameha is summoned to Kau by King Kalaniʻōpuʻu, the ruler of Hawaii Island, whose health is in decline. He wants to discuss defending the kingdom against an inevitable invasion by Kahekili. Then we cut back to the British ship, where we learn that Kaiana intends to acquire as many firearms as he can and return home to arm his family and others against Kahekili. The ship docks in Zamboanga in the Philippines, and Kaiana goes ashore in search of weapons. He meets a Hawaiian woman named Vi, who has carved out a life in the shady underworld of the busy port. She helps him secure guns and passage home from Kaiana's ship's captain in exchange for a stake in starting a sandalwood trade in Hawaii. And we cut back to Waipio Valley, where Ka'ahumanu is ceremoniously wed to Kamehameha, and the marriage is consummated with the village as witnesses. Meanwhile, back in Zamboanga, one of the nefarious sailors from Kaiana's ship, his name is Marley, makes his own deal with a different ship captain to exploit the resources in Hawaii. Kaiana's friend and shipmate Tony finds out about the plan, and when he confronts Marley, Tony is beaten, then the screen cuts to black.
Yes, so this episode, as you stated, fast-forwarded 1 year into the future and took on a number of new and really important developments in our story. While there was quite a bit going on, I think two topics that really stood out to us when we kind of went over the episode and that we wanted to bring more light to in today's podcast are, number one, the Hawaiian perception of marriage, arranged marriages, multiple spouses, consummating a marriage. This was a central theme of this episode and one that deserves more attention. And then number two, the introduction of capitalism and the notion of selling Hawaiian lands and resources and what this means from past to present. This has always been a very contentious topic in our islands. Yep. Now, I know that this jumps ahead of our usual format, but it's also a good segue into our first topic of discussion. So, Russell, can you explain to everyone your most questionable moment in this episode?
The most questionable moment for me, and I mean this more as a moment that raised many questions for me, is the scene where Kamehameha and Ka'ahumanu consummate their union and the village watches their silhouette of their consummation. And I mentioned in the last episode that my parents took me to church growing up, so I do tend to see many things through a Protestant lens. So this practice is strange to me. And I know a similar thing happens in other cultures, so I shouldn't be taken so aback by it, but I am, and I need to find some clarification on this practice.
Russell, I actually chose the same scene in the episode as my questionable moment. And as I told you already, this was my favorite episode, but this scene was, I didn't like it. Maybe for different reasons. Personally, I haven't encountered any historical information about men and women consummating their marriage on display for the entire community to watch. So I'm assuming this was more of a Hollywood addition used to play into Ka'ahumanu and her father's concern regarding the prophecy that Ka'ahumanu is unable to bear a child for Kamehameha. And in this respect, it makes sense to highlight their anxiety.
That makes a little bit more sense to me. And real quick, before we talk more about that, if this wasn't a historically documented way of consummating a marriage in Hawaiian culture, were there any ceremonies? Like, do they just go into their hale and they do their thing and that was it?
Well, you know, honestly, I can't really say. Okay. I think marriage, there were definitely ceremonies for all types of things that happen. And maybe if you were of a chiefly line, like Kamehameha yeah. and Ka'ahumanu were, there would be more strict protocol that would go along with it. But marriage was more fluid in Hawaii, as opposed to being defined by really strict boundaries. And you bring up a good point, this idea of, you know, having children and your lineage being passed down. And this was really important in Hawaii, and it was something that was considered sacred because we would trace our genealogies all the way back to the beginning of time, yeah. right? So if you're going to preserve your genealogies with such care and detail, obviously you're going to want to ensure that it continues. However, what we also see and what we know about Ka'ahumanu is while she doesn't bear children for Kamehameha, she basically takes on a mother role to all of his other wives' children. So even though maybe she wasn't their biological mom, she had a role in their upbringing, in their education, in the skills that they learned. And so I think this idea of sharing families and sharing children was really important and valued in our society as well. Now, back to this idea of, you know, marriage being a little bit more fluid in Hawaii, you know, this might be something that is a little bit more difficult for people who grow up, like you said, in the Protestant church or other religions or accustomed to society where it's a little bit more strict in some respects today, right? Men and women in traditional Hawaii often had multiple companions. This was not, you know, unusual. It was very common. They often had children with various partners. And as this episode showed in an earlier scene with Kupule and his Aikane, sometimes had same-gendered lovers. So relationships and lovemaking in Hawaii was a really dynamic landscape, to say the least. Having children with selected spouses was often about preserving or enhancing chiefly genealogies and strengthening or securing diplomatic ties between ruling families. And sometimes just because a man and woman would have children together, it didn't mean till death do us part. And they were always together. Sometimes it was their kuleana to have children together to, again, promote their genealogy, to bring families together. And once they had a few keiki, they would go off and do other things and be with other companions. So it wasn't necessarily love. It might have been more kuleana, again, a responsibility, yeah. which was also looked to as a privilege. You know, it's your privilege to have this genealogy. You need to make sure that it gets passed down into the next generation. Now, with things like same-gendered lovers, you know, this was often a form of companionship for people who served as advisors, as was the case with Kupule in this episode, right? Or who went to battle with one another, a form of trust and an intimate tie together. It was also a way to avoid combining genealogies if there were any reasons that would warrant refraining from having shared lineages. So again, very dynamic love landscape in Hawaii.
Like I said, I grew up, you know, looking through the world through a Protestant lens. So a lot of this is new, but a lot of this is very interesting to understand about our culture and our history.
Yeah. And that idea of looking at the world through a different lens, it's so helpful mm-hmm. when we try to understand other people's perspectives, even if it's not our own, we can still respect and we yeah. can still be like, yeah. oh, okay, I see that that worked for them. Maybe it doesn't work for me, but yeah. it's a good way of being able to take on lots of new information and ways of living from various cultures around the entire world, yeah. right? And create more love and respect for each other.
Real quick, before we move on, I wanted to go back to the idea that Ka'ahumanu will not bear children for Kamehameha. Was there a penalty, like some sort of bad consequence or bad repercussion if a queen is not able to produce an heir for a king?
I think this is also part of the reason why they had multiple partners.
Yeah.
I mean, Kamehameha had five or more wives that I can think of. And so it was never this idea that he wasn't going to have children. And similarly for women, right? Because women also took on really important roles. They were chiefs and chiefesses too, right, in our society. And so they wanted to have their own children. And a lot of times when we really look at genealogy in Hawaii, it was traced through the woman. Right. Because you know, when I carry a baby, Russell, for 9 months in my body and I have to push it out, I know without a doubt in my mind that that is my child.
Yeah.
My husband is pretty certain it's his child.
Right.
I'm pretty certain too. Okay. But it's always like when push came to shove in our genealogies, both lines would be honored, but the mother's line oftentimes would kind of take the priority because she birthed that child. And lots of times our children would be like, they would have multiple fathers that were recognized, like Kamehameha, because they don't actually know exactly who the biological dad was. So I haven't really heard, I mean, maybe it did happen. Other historians might have found other information, but I haven't heard of, you know, strict penalty or punishment for women that couldn't bear children. Instead, what I've seen is these women will like hanai other children and make them their own, or be a mother to children of women who they share a spouse with.
Yeah.
And so it's still a really important way to have this motherly and this way of passing down your knowledge and your history, even if you don't bear children yourself.
That's good, because we hear about in European histories, right, queens that don't produce heirs for their kings, they get executed or they get exiled. So it sounds like within our culture, responsibility is just placed elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, look at the word makua. One of the meanings of makua is a parent. And when we look at how makua was used, it wasn't just used for your mom and dad, but it was used for your auntie and your uncle. And so this notion of everyone in your community has a really important role in helping to raise you. Yeah. And everyone in that generation above you, you show respect to, just like they were your biological mom or dad. And I think this is a tradition that has carried on very nicely into modern society, which is why everyone and anyone who's older than you, when you grow up in Hawaii, it's auntie or uncle, right? And I remember the first time I was like in college and a teacher told me, oh, it's just call me Jack, you know? And it was so uncomfortable, right? You've experienced that too. And you're just like, oh my gosh, I can't do it. I'm just not going to call him anything, you know? Because it's a form of respect.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's move on to our next topic. We both wanted to discuss capitalism.
Yeah.
And Russell, why do you feel this was such an important topic issue in this episode?
Oh, man, there are so many reasons. And I think the primary one being that some historians and cultural practitioners trace the loss of Hawaii's sovereignty and land to our people being exploited by capitalism. Mm. It's important to know that Hawaiians didn't view land and resources through the lens of capitalism. Land was an ancestor, a family member. It wasn't something to be bought or sold or exploited for resources. We had a symbiotic relationship where the people cared for the land and the land took care of the people. We weren't prepared for capitalism and the use of force that comes with it. They kind of scratched the surface on the issue in this episode. And I think that's important for people to understand that part of Hawaii's history.
I wasn't expecting this topic to be a part of Chief of War at all, but I am pleasantly surprised and appreciative of the writer's deliberate inclusion. I found Kaʻiana's stoic nature when dealing with trade to represent the Hawaiian worldview that you described so accurately. Yeah. He just really wasn't interested in it. He wasn't amused. For example, when he's on the ship and Tony brings his ration, when Kaʻiana doesn't want to take part in the food, Tony tells him, "We'll sell it or trade it with one of the crew members." And Kaʻiana's response is, "They have nothing I want."
Your ration. You don't want it, sell it. Or trade with one of the men.
They have nothing I want.
And so what a great line, right? And it's very telling and important in regards to, like you said, how we viewed land, how we viewed resources, how we viewed other goods and taking care of ourselves. In fact, we learn that really the only thing Kaʻiana is interested in from the Ilikea are guns. And we see him learning about guns, practicing with them, and then searching for some way to acquire them. And there's some pretty cool scenes in the episode where he's, you know, in the mountains and he's in the snow and he's practicing shooting and he's getting more equipped with it and he's learning how to clean it and all of this. I thought that was really well done to show that this became this form of what we call haole mana. Really, haole mana means foreign power. And that becomes kind of the center of what Hawaiians view as these Europeans having that could be advantageous. Hawaiians understand really quickly that these items, that guns, that cannons, that weapons, have a very specific use and could possibly benefit specific endeavors, war.
One thing I took away from Kaʻiana's focus on acquiring guns is really this strong love of his family and of his people and of his land, that he was so just focused on the best way to defend against such a large and skilled army as Kahikili's. What I saw from that focus from him is just his love for his family.
I think he was trying to make right his wrongs, right? Yeah, and the wrongs being that he now regrets having participated in Kahikili's invasion of Oahu and, you know, the slaughter of all of these innocent people. And what we do know is, historically, Kamehameha does use European weapons and firearms to successfully unify the islands. He uses guns and cannons in some of his battles. And there are many in academia who will say, if it hadn't been for actually the availability of these weapons and learning how to use them, perhaps Kamehameha wouldn't have been able to unify the islands, you know, or maybe not right at that time.
The other reason I think it's important that they included this perspective on capitalism in this episode is because it's a big part of why our land is slipping out of our hands today. And I interviewed the Hawaiian playwright Alani Apio recently. He wrote the Kamau trilogy that was staged at Kumukahua Theater last year.
Ooh, love that theater.
Yeah. Oh. And it examines Hawaiians' loss of land and culture and its effect on recent generations. At the end of our interview, he says this.
Back in 2000, I wrote this searing editorial about the loss of our lands and our culture called A Thousand Tiny Cuts to Genocide. And in it, I proposed that over my lifetime, I would see the loss of our culture because we didn't have sovereignty and thus we didn't have control over land and language where we could practice and be. I had the wrong reason. I thought it was because we didn't have land and language. And in one sense, it is true. But what I didn't realize that had been happening all along is that the economy of the United States, the capitalist economy that we live under and have lived under since the late 1800s, has been forcing not only Kanaka Oʻiwi, but local people to leave these islands since the mid-1900s. And as we most all know now, there are more Kanaka living outside of Hawaii than are living in it. And so what I see is we're going to lose our islands and we're being bought out by the wealthy and rich from all over the world that can afford it. And it's all legal under United States law.
And so what we see in the episode is kind of the introduction of the idea of capitalism in Hawaii, selling sandalwood to make money. And this is an idea that comes from Vai. And in the place she is in the moment, she sees that as a good thing. But what's great is Kaʻiana pushes back, right? You would sell our home.
They do not know where our small islands lie. And you will have Kaʻiana to help convince the chiefs of our home to allow it.
You sell our home by Aina. Tilikea, pale skin.
No, the trade would be ours. The money to benefit our people.
And so this introduction of this idea of capitalism, we can see its effects today in the fact that homes are so expensive here, and not only so expensive, but not available for us Hawaiians, for us locals. And I'm grateful that Pop wrote this into the script, because this is a really important thing for people to understand the genesis of how we began to lose our land and our culture.
And perhaps, you know, you and I have taken a small part of this episode and turned it into a much bigger and heavier topic.
Yeah.
But hey, isn't that actually a great thing? Using a series to inspire a deeper conversation, learn more, maybe even impact positive change. So as you mentioned, right, being priced out of paradise is a topic that Hawaiians and longtime local residents have been dealing with and fighting against for at least 2 to 3 generations now. And while people may have various opinions on capitalism, on religion, on politics, on everything else under the sun, what we know is that as a result of the introduction of capitalism to Hawaii, by and large, the citizens of Hawaii suffered. And today, many of our Kanaka and longtime local residents deal with tremendous socioeconomic disparity. So this episode, with the talk of trade and sandalwood, alludes to the exploitation of our land and resources that is about to happen, maybe in the show. They're going to probably show some of it, as well as that we know also happened historically, right? And I'm not against trade, right? We know that trade can be really beneficial.
Right.
I mean, like in Hawaii today, you know, things like iPhones and computers, we're using our laptops right now, right? We couldn't make those in our islands. We don't have the resources for them, but they're very useful. Though we do know where Hawaii's headed. We go from being 100% self-sufficient to today about 90% dependent on outside resources.
Yeah.
So we don't actually, through capitalism, head to a more advantageous position for our residents and for our islands. And our islands used to be able to sustain a population of about 1 million people. And today, there's no way our islands could do that. It doesn't mean that there aren't efforts in place to try and get back to that, but it has become much more difficult with kind of this big emphasis on money, as opposed to the traditional emphasis, which was on land and resources and family. And so this episode, where we're seeing this marketplace and these goods, and we hear Vi talking about sandalwood and money, you and I are immediately going, oh, this is, it's starting to head down that path, and it's a scary path, and we want to warn them, like, maybe don't.
I do want to make one thing clear. I'm not advocating for an economic system, you know, outside of capitalism. This is the reality of where we are today and where we live today. But maybe we can change how we approach how we consume goods, or maybe we can change the way that we approach how we view land. You know, I don't see capitalism going away, but maybe we can change us. Maybe we can change the way we approach it.
And the access. The access that, like you said, people have to land and resources. And I think we can learn quite a bit from Hawaiian ancestors about this idea of taking care of your communities. Mm-hmm. And this idea of, you know, in traditional Hawaiian society, no one was like exceptionally rich, but no one was in a desolate, poor condition. Mm-hmm. People had what they needed. And by having what they needed, life, I mean, we're looking at war, but life in general, when you look at stories from our community, was a pretty good life. Not perfect, but a pretty good life, where on average, it was estimated that at the pinnacle of Hawaiian society, people only had to work about 4 hours a day. I don't know about you, Russell, but I would love to only work 4 hours a day.
Oh, that would be beautiful.
Right? And then what did they do with the rest of their time? They devoted themselves to incredible arts and crafts. They went surfing. They, you know, played different games. They developed different skills. And so I think that, like you said, we live in a capitalistic society and there are benefits to it. Mm-hmm. But there are also deep benefits to learning about what worked in our island so well for the people who survived here for thousands of years prior to European contact.
All right. We'll be right back after a short break.
Velina mai kako. This is Paige Okamura, DJ Mermaid, me ke konoa ke aloha, to join me every Sunday evening for an exploration into Hawaiian music from the past to the present, where we'll dive into the artists, composers, lyrics and mo'olelo that make up the rich tapestry of Hawaiian music. That's Hawaii Kula Iwi, every Sunday from 6 to 7, here on HPR One.
Let's jump into the categories. First one, most impactful or chicken skin moment. For me, It was the scene where Kamehameha appears before Kalaniopuu and Keoua for two reasons. One, growing up on the Big Island, these are legendary historical figures for me. In fact, I feel like this is the first time that Kamehameha and Kalaniopuu have been portrayed on screen. They've been mentioned before. I'm thinking of Dragon Ball video games. And then there's this episode in the original Magnum PI called The Treasure of Kalaniopuu. So they have been mentioned, but this is the first time we really get to see them portrayed on screen, which is really cool for me. The second reason is because Kalaniopuu is played by Hawaii actor Branscombe Richmond.
Oh, what a beautiful choice.
Yeah, and he's been in the industry for 50 years as a stuntman and a character actor. He was that guy that I looked to growing up that reassured me that Hawaiians and Polynesians could have a career in film and TV. And when I saw him on screen with the legendary Cliff Curtis portraying an Ali'i Nui speaking in Alolo Hawaii, I'm super glad that Branscombe got that role, and I can't wait to talk to him about what that meant to him as a longtime Polynesian in the film industry.
Okay, for me, it was the scene where Vi is trying to negotiate a deal with the Europeans to harvest Hawaiian iliahi. And in response to her proposition, Kaiana sternly questions her, "You sell our home." And when she tries to justify her reasoning, he states, "You've been gone too long." And this to me was like, boom, Kanani,
yeah.
You know, like in your face, Vi, I don't know what you're thinking. You've been away too long. And I thought it was powerful. It was also foreboding of the changes that lie ahead, because in the end of the scene, Vi tells Kaiana, "You should too," you know, in regards to thinking about the world from the pale skin perspective, right? You should also regard the world as the pale skins do. Otherwise, you're going to be in trouble. You're going to be left behind.
Yeah. Character that brought the most heat or performance that we really liked. I really liked K.L. Moku and the work that Moses Goods is putting in.
Yeah.
We all know how hard it is to balance responsibility and family, and his acceptance of the situation is apparent. But I also feel like there's some conflict, right, just below the surface. Moses is juggling all these emotions and pulling off a great performance. So hats off to him. I also real quick want to give a shout out to local actor Levi Tuiala. He plays the character of Oahu Man in the scene where the Oahu chief is forced to pledge his loyalty to Kahikili. That was the role that I auditioned for, and Levi crushed it. Good on you for getting that role and for being part of this production.
Yes, but I'm a fan of Russell, so I would have loved to have seen you in that role. Maybe another one in the future.
Hopefully, keeping my fingers crossed for season two.
Okay, I'm going to go with Tony. So he's someone who's in a difficult position. He really doesn't fit in with anyone, and he chooses to align himself with Kaiana. Since the first time we saw him, he was scared of what Marley called, what was the word, the sand devils.
Take a generous pour, gentlemen. You've earned it.
Some for Kaiana, too.
Still don't know why Captain pulled him from the water. Sand-loving devils never do that for us.
Yeah, I've never heard us referred by that as well.
I liked before. It. Yeah. I thought it was great. Yeah, go ahead. Call us the sand devils. But he's also very respectful and appears genuinely interested in Kaiana and the Hawaiian people's well-being. So I love a good ally. I appreciate a good ally. And I hope he's okay.
Oh,
because
me
at the
too.
End of the episode, right, we don't know what happens to him.
Yeah.
So.
Love this guy, Tony. He's been a good friend to Kaiana. So great character. This is the point in time where we usually talk about our most questionable moment, but we've already discussed it. The consummation of the marriage between Kamehameha and Kahumanu.
Yeah. I wasn't a fan of the scene for the reasons we previously mentioned. I also wasn't a fan of the scene in general, probably because it really wasn't much of a show. I mean, if you're going to get it on in front of the entire community, let's give them something a little bit more exciting. It was a bit boring as well as an uncomfortable love scene. So no, thank you.
Okay. All right. We're going to move on to what we've renamed the Meredith Artley Most Momoa Moment.
That goes good together.
I'm going to go with the scene in the beginning where Kaiana is hunting with the Alaska native and he shoots the caribou. For one, if you follow Jason on social media, you get the impression that he's a man of the wild, that he enjoys being outside, doing really traditionally masculine stuff. And this moment kind of jives with his social media persona. The scene is also honorable mention for my most questionable moment, because muskets are only accurate up to about 80 yards. And I don't think they were that close to this animal.
Jason Momoa, yeah, Russell.
Yeah, just his sheer coolness probably willed that musket ball to...
It was the wink.
Yeah.
Mine's would be when Katyana's on the rowboat headed to the marketplace and he's dressed in his ahu'ula, his mahiole, and he's carrying his ihe. I cracked up laughing at the scene. Everything around Katyana is so drab and common. And here he comes, completely sticking out in every way possible. And he really could care less. It's a Momoa moment. This is who I am. Kiko Po, you know, end of story. Yeah. That's it.
What prop or artifact would you want from this episode? For me, it's the captain's map of the Hawaiian Islands. I'd frame it. I'd put it in my office. Also, I just love maps. I don't know what it is. I can stare at one for hours. We have this enormous map in the station, and I'm in danger every day of being frozen in front of it, learning the names of different places and imagining what it would take to get there. Also, watching Jason Momoa eat raw fish on the ship makes me want to eat raw fish too. And I'm not saying that I'd want that exact fish that was used in the production, but I'm pretty sure I'll end up eating sashimi tonight, or at least a poke bowl.
My take-home prop is the pink pa'u dress that Ka'ahumanu wears when she meets up with Kupu'ohi in the forest, and the two of them are practicing slinging their weapons at the tree. It's elegant, and yet she's being very athletic in what she's doing. It's very well done. I wouldn't be surprised if this show helps to elevate various Hawaiian fashions and artists.
Yeah. Last category, hot take, or our prediction for next episode or the series finale. In our last episode, I predicted a tear-jerking reunion between Katyana and Kupu'ohi.
You were hopeful.
I was very hopeful. But now that we know that a whole year has passed since they last saw each other, and more time may pass before Katyana can return home, the opportunity for her to move on grows. Ooh. And I'm a sucker for a love story subplot, so I'm rooting for an untainted reunion. But I also know that human nature... and good stories come from conflict. So I'm guessing Kupu'ohi will at least entertain the idea of moving on in the next episode. But don't do it. Don't do it, Kupu'ohi.
I hope she waits for Katyana. He's working so hard to get home. Anyway, my prediction is that Katyana will return home, having secured a number of firearms. He'll reunite successfully with Kupu'ohi, and he'll form a special bond with Kamehameha. With the aid of John Young, who we've already seen a couple times, they'll prepare to take on Kahekilima with their new firearms that they have. Also, Marley. We saw Marley at the end of this episode, right? And he's conspiring against the captain, and he wants to get his own foothold in on the Iliahi trade. I think he's going to set up a partnership, and he'll set sail for Hawaii to cause their own set of problems. And something my husband and I were discussing with this episode is, my husband was saying, hey, that's really a good plot with how they're stealing the map. Because it's not like today where we can GPS everything and text people our location, right? Finding locations, finding new locations was probably very significant during this period of time of explorers and trade, right? And so the idea that this could have happened in, you know, some shady area where a map is stolen and a plot is created and more people start heading to an island to try and exploit its resources, totally could have happened.
Oh, yeah. So as I mentioned before, I was really struck by the introduction of Hawaii Island King Kalani Opu'u into the series. He's played by Branscombe Richmond. And the awesome thing is that he lives on Maui. And I had the opportunity to sit down with him on Maui amidst the chirping birds and a lively set of wind chimes and talk to him about his experience on Chief of War.
Well, let me first start out by saying that my three sons started filming on Oahu at the very beginning because they are stuntmen and actors as well. So I was feeling a little left out. You know what I mean? It's like, whoa, my boys. But I was very proud and happy that they got in. And, you know, if you saw them in the first episode, they gave good death in the first episode, and they continue to do it on all nine. So, you know, you realize that, hey, there'll be something else, right? And then all of a sudden, I got a call from Pa. And he said, we've edited the show. And now we are kind of seeing what's missing. And I'd like to talk to you about playing Kalaniopuu. And I said, what? Really? I didn't know much about him, but I knew enough to say, oh my gosh, there's some response, there's some Kuleana here. So my wife, who went to Kamehameha, she sat me down and gave me the whole deal. And naturally, I wanted to be a part of this, you know, and I said, yes, I'll do it. So I went to Hawaiian language school, right? They make you go through the whole, everybody. And, you know, you don't want to sound like a guy who's speaking Spanish for the first time. You know what I mean? So after 2 months, I've learned my lines. Fly to New Zealand, which was wonderful and beautiful. And there's a lot of aloha there, I got to tell you, man. And the set was wonderful. It was a great place. Yeah, so that's how I got the part. And I'm grateful to Pa'a for that. I'm grateful to Jason, too, because, you know, biting off a piece of the business to get your historical family story told never happens. I'm going to tell you right now. I think the timing was wonderful because of Shogun. Shogun was all in Japanese. It made people who were on the outside looking in, you know, people from Nebraska, people from Omaha, wherever, Kansas City, they were interested. Do you know what I mean?
You've been in the industry for 50 plus years in various roles too, right? As stuntman, actor, producer. When you look back at your career, when you look at how Hawaii has been portrayed in the movies since you've been involved, what does this production mean?
This means so much to me, man. It's one of those moments of your life that you go, wow, I've done something important. You know, in the 70s, Eric Estrada was going to play Duke Hanamoku, okay? He was a hit series. The network was looking at bringing Duke Hanamoku out, and Eric Estrada was going to play that part. Then there was a script running around town in the 80s about King Kamehameha. Arnold Schwarzenegger was going to play that guy. They never got made, but that is the business of the business. You see what I mean? I didn't play Polynesians for many years. I was playing the bad guys, the brown bad guys. And in every television show, there's five bad guys and there's one good guy. And if you're taller than the good guy, there's a good chance you're going to get that role. And that was because of my size and my height, I was able to get those things. And then all of a sudden, you know, the Polynesian role started to come out a little bit, but it was not necessarily Polynesian. It was people of the Pacific, specifically in Hawaii, that is such a mixed group that when you went into an interview, there were folks who you would see living on Oahu today. So there'd be Chinese, Filipino, Japanese, Korean, a whole mix. And those are the guys going up for the Hawaii roles. And then rarely you saw a Samoan guy in there. And then all of a sudden, as years went around, the Samoan actors started to come on in Los Angeles. So it was kind of interesting that you could see where this industry kind of grew. And it's because of guys like The Rock and because of Jason. This is a historical moment in cinema to have Olelo Hawaii for people to tell this story. I don't want to say too much about Chief of War, but I will say this. You had more Native Hawaiians / Polynesians behind the camera and in front of the camera than any other show that I've been on. Now, I'll say it again. No one could bring this to the forefront to say to Apple Plus, hey, I got a dream. I wanted to show about my people, even though I was raised in Iowa. Dig that. And the Momoa Ohana is from Hana. They're from Hana. So as we're doing this interview on Maui, It's a big deal, man. I just hope it can happen again. I mean, he's made a statement here. It's huge. And it's not cheeks of war. It is chief of war. Come on, ladies, stop it. That's all I heard at the screening. Look at Jason's cheeks. Cheeks of war.
That was my interview with legendary Hawaii actor Branscombe Richmond, who plays Kalani Opu'u in this episode of Chief of War. And that's it for this episode of Feathers and Fire, HBR's Chief of War After Show podcast. I'm Russell Subiono.
I'm Mehana Makainai. Thanks so much for listening. And thanks again to our guests, Branscombe Richmond.
This episode was written by myself and Mehana and produced by me and Savannah Harriman-Pope.
We owe a lot to the HPR marketing team, Liberty Peralta and Sylvia Flores, as well as Sophia McCullough. They get the word out about our podcast and ensure it's ready for you every Saturday.
Big mahalo to HPR's president and CEO, Meredith Artley, who continues to be just as excited about this project as we are. Not sure if I should tell her our chances of getting Jason Momoa as a guest is probably pretty slim.
Shucks. No.
We could try.
Let's put good energy out there. Our theme song is Clarity by Kenny Endo from the album Eternal Energy. Learn more about Kenny and his music, as well as his traditional and contemporary Japanese drumming school, Taiko Center of the Pacific, at kennyendo.com.
Our next episode will discuss episode 4 of Chief of War, City of Flowers Part 2. You can download it on Saturday, August 16th from Apple, Spotify, Pandora, or the HPR website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Russell Subiono. Aloha and mahalo for listening.
I'm Mehana Makainai. Until next time, pipi holo ka'au.